I remember Joe Campbell, too, who is one of my heroes, saying, the important thing is not to just live, but to find out what myth you're living, so you can live it more intelligently. Then after you've done that, when you're a little older, you can find out what myth is living you. It's important in terms of consciousness not simply to live and pretend that you're running your own life and you have a very individual life, etc., etc. Mythologically, that doesn't happen. Try to use your consciousness, Joseph Campbell says, to find out what myth you are living. Then you memorize the myth and you find out, are you a third of the way through it, a half a way through it? Where are you? So that's a good occupation for the middle part of life. Then in the later part of life, you might try to find out what myth is living you. You sound a little confused. Yeah, that's... Joe didn't say any more, so I won't say any more. I feel a little pensive today, so we'll have a different sort of a morning, I think, than yesterday. And I had some complaints, too, about not giving you a break, so if you'd like a break in the middle for 5 minutes or so, all right. Yes. There's a request that when I say a poem, will I say its title? Some poems don't have titles, you know. But I think yesterday, did I do 50 males sitting together? That's the one about lifting something up. That's, you'll find that in this book called Selected Poems. It's also in a book of mine. The first book I did on men's things called The Man in the Black Coat Turns. What else did I do? I did Snow Geese, which is also from Selected Poems. Did I do any other poems yesterday? The poem by Juan Ramon Jimenez, which I began with, I am not I, yo no soy yo. What did I do last evening? I did a poem by Kabir. We'll all do that again tonight, because at 10 o'clock tonight, we'll have a pleasure because our young musicians from Philadelphia, a very brilliant young American who plays the sitar, will be coming in. And we'll be doing Indian religious poetry of the 13th century and 13th and 14th century. And we'll be doing some Muslim religious poetry of Rumi of the 13th century. Here. So this is a little gift that I just... we decided to do for you. I think you'll enjoy it very much. And the sitar, of course, is now, this is a bouzouki, and it has one quality with the sitar. It has the resonators. The guitar does not have that. The metal resonator penetrates into the brain somewhere. Can you feel it? No. Mm-hmm. all can be sung about it. Somehow the resonator is connected to grief. Do it, but you can feel what it could be like if you had to sing them. It's interesting, you know, that the Muslims with Muhammad, one difference between Muhammad and the people that laid out the Christian work was that, I'm just saying this now, and I, like most of what I say, it may not be true. But Muhammad was a genius in sound, so that he knew that certain sounds penetrate through the body and awaken cells, awaken energy in the body. The Quran, when you read it in translation, appears to be nothing, and we're always complaining about that. And there's a wonderful book recently that says, well, the point is, do not read it in translation. See, it's memorized all over the Muslim world. And when it's memorized, the sounds that are in the Quran penetrate into the body. It's a little like the Latin Mass. And how much was lost when it went into English, because now the people don't understand the sound anymore as they did at that time. Translation is not it. The sounds and how they penetrate into the body are it. Second thing that Muhammad understood, that unless men can read together and chant, they will lose their religion. And when you go to Ireland, you'll see mainly women in the churches. In the Sufi work, which could be called the pro-woman branch of the Muhammadans, Khomeini is not a member of that group, as you can imagine. The men meet once a week, and a lot of their work is done in chanting. And the Muslims, as you know, I mean, the Sufis, as you know, probably know, were outlawed in Turkey when Kemal Ataturk came in, because he felt that to modernize Turkey, the main obstacle was the Sufis, who were too much in their bodies and too much in the ecstatic parts of their bodies and would not give in to factories. So it was made a crime. You can shoot a Sufi on sight if you see him in the street, if he's wearing any of his clothes. So since that time, many Sufis have been killed in Turkey, and the rest have their things in private rooms. So one of those Turks working that way came to New York, and I was with him about a year and a half ago. And his old man came in and said all these things, and he had about 50 men there who were doing the chants. And then the Hafiz spoke up. A Hafiz is a man who has memorized the entire Quran. So the men were chanting, and all of a sudden the Hafiz came in, and his voice went, they were chanting and his voice went, and five or ten of the men burst out crying immediately. And the purpose of that is to carry men's grief so they do not become separated from their grief. You hear that? So that's the opposite of the Kiwanis. A cheerful man is not a man at all. An optimistic man is just a delayed boy. So let me begin then. We have a few things to do today, and I'll begin with a poem from a book of mine called Loving a Woman in Two Worlds. You have a copy of there. Could I have that? Oh, thank you. He said sign it too. I'll do that first. Um, This is a little book of poems I wrote for my wife, and it took me 10 years to write. And love poems are very difficult to write because they go out of tune somehow so easily. It's like an instrument. And in my selected poems, I mentioned a little thing here when I put a little introduction to the selected poems, I mean to the poems. I said something like, love poems seem to ask for every bit of musicianship we have because they can so easily go out of tune. If the poem veers too far toward actual events, then the eternal feeling is lost in the static of our complexes. Well, I put in inadequacies because complexes are really too psychological. It's lost in the static of our inadequacies. And if we confine the poem only to what we feel, the other person disappears. If we confine the poem to what we feel, then the other person disappears. You see, that's a big problem in writing love poems. If you stay here in the chest, then you never even find out if the woman, what color the woman's hair is. She's a Republican or a Democrat. You read a whole book and you never know that. There's no real way to solve this problem. So, can you hear me all right? Yeah. I'll give you... I can bring it up a little bit. The eternal ends of sentences. I'm a little pensive today. This is called Winter Poem. We're staying to the theme here of the wound, shall we? The quivering wings of the winter ant wait for lean winter to end. I love you in slow, dim-witted ways, hardly speaking, one or two words only. What caused us each to live hidden? A wound, the wind, a word. Apparent. Sometimes we wait in a helpless way, awkwardly, not whole and not healed. When we hid the wound, originally our head, when we took the wound, I changed it. When we hid the wound, we fell back from a human to a shelled life. Now we feel the ant's hard chest, the carapace, the silent tongue. This must be the way of the ant. The winter ant, the way of those who are wounded and who want to live, to breathe, to sense another, and to wait. What's wrong? I'll tell you a little bit about the book. After about 7 years, I thought it was finished. But I looked at it, and it was starting up about 4 feet off the ground and then going up. That's where we started long form, you know, already 4 feet off the ground. Mm-hmm. But that isn't really where our life started. So I took another couple of years to try to build a base under that, sort of go down and touch the suffering of my family, is that clear? And of ourselves. So this is one of the base poems, the ones that in the first section that I put in. The quivering wing of the winter ant, wait for lean winter to end. I love you in slow, dim-witted ways, hardly speaking, one or two words only. What caused us each to live hidden? A wound? The wind? A word? A parent? Sometimes we wait in a helpless way, awkwardly, not whole and not healed. When we hid the wound, we fell back from a human to a shelled life. You know the life of the mollusk? From a human to a shelled life. Now we feel the ant's hard chest, the carapace, the silent tongue. This must be the way of the ant, the winter ant, the way of those who are wounded and who want to live. To breathe, to sense another, and to wait. I'll give you a little poem that I wrote in the end of the book, and then I'll go on and do something else. I went to Russia with my wife about a year and a half ago. We were met at the airport by Igor, who is from Writers Union. He's not too bright, but in the car was Frida, who's about a 65-year-old woman who is a translator and has worked in the Writers Union for a long time. And when I went over there before, about 4 years ago, we were wandering around and... And after a day or so, I went and sat down with, I said to Frida, do you mind if I sit down next to you? And she said, no. I said, I feel at home with you. She said, that's strange. That's what Robert Frost said when he was here 20 years ago. So that was Frida. So Frida was in the taxi when we left the airport. And so Igor said, what's the name of your new book, Robert? I said, the name is Loving a Woman in Two Worlds. He said, that's strange, because over here we just play with them, you know. So he said, can you give me one of the poems? So I said, Frida, can you translate one? She said, sure. So I said, I'll give you a little four-line poem. So this is a poem that Frida, and I don't know, the Russian and English is so different, I recited the poem, and then she says, come on, come on, come on. Every breath taken by the man who loves and the woman who loves goes to fill the water tank where the spirit horses drink. I get it to you once more. There are two traditions, you know. One is that the spirit is connected from here up, and then sex is from there down. And they're not connected. So the hinge at your waist, and that's it. So that's a rather modern tradition. The ancient tradition is that there's a kind of a spiral going. Every breath taken by the man who loves and the woman who loves goes to fill the water tank where the spirit horses drink. Get it? All right. At breakfast this morning, someone asked me to do a poem of Rainer Maria Rilke. He's a very great poet, as you know. The greatest religious poet for 500 years, probably. Rainer Maria Rilke, the German poet. And I have a book of his out now called Selected Poems of Rilke, if you want to find this particular poem I'm going to recite in it. Sometimes a man stands up during supper and walks outdoors and keeps on walking because of a church that stands somewhere in the east. And his children say blessings on him as if he had died. And another man who stays inside his own house dies there inside the dishes and the glasses so that his children have to go far out into the world toward that same church which he forgot. That comes into the question of unlived life that we mentioned earlier. If your parents refuse to live their religious life, then the children will. So it's always recommended live as many lives as you can. Live your sexual life, live your wild life, live your religious life, so that your children can choose what they wish to live. If you leave out any of the lives and the desire to be perfect, as Jung said, don't try to be perfect, try to be complete. It's a different thing. All the Swiss try to be perfect. That's very interesting, because there's a great division in Christianity on that point as to whether you should be whole, live a whole lot, be an idiot as well as a scholar, be a sensual person as well as a prayer, or whether you should just choose one slice of the pie, be perfect right there, and your kids will be a mess. That's what the theory says. It's called the theory of unlived life. Are you ready to go on with this? Sometimes a man stands up during supper and walks outdoors and keeps on walking because of a church that stands somewhere in the east. And Wilke's not talking about any individual church. He's talking about a religious life chosen. Sometimes a man stands up during supper and walks outdoors and keeps on walking because of a church that stands somewhere in the east. And then it's so strange. And his children say blessings on him as if he had died. That's a hard line. I'm not sure it'd be always true. But we can understand what he's saying. Because the man lived his life, didn't he? Lived it. That's a blessing to the children. And the children say blessings on him, as if he had died. And another man who remains inside his own house dies there, inside the dishes and in the glasses. So that his children have to go far out into the world toward that same church which he forgot. Is it clear? So strange, because I was building a little house in a cabin in the middle of Minnesota where I do some writing, and a young man was up there putting on some logs, you know, boards, and I walked in, and he said, "You know, Robert, when you were in Seattle 2 years ago," he said, "you recited a poem by Rilke, which poem? I said, and he named this one. And I said, you remember that? He said, yes. As a matter of fact, that's why I'm here. I said, what do you mean? He said, my father, every night, put the clothes into the washing machine. And finally, I couldn't stand it. And I left. Now, he didn't mean it was wrong for men to help with the washing. That isn't what he meant. He meant that his father had no other life except putting the clothes into the washing machine. And as a son, this was a humiliation and a betrayal so deep that he couldn't stand to be in the house anymore. We're going to talk about that thing this morning. You feel that one? Yeah. Anyone else? That one has no name. It's this whole series that Rilke wrote. People refer to it by, sometimes a man stands up during supper. That's the first line. Sometimes a man stands up during supper. It's in the book called Selected Poems by Rilke, in my translation. All right, so let's go on now, and I want to do one remark and then a poem, because I promised you, I'll do this one. We were talking a little about shame yesterday, and I'll just make a remark that one could say that what we're going to do today, to a certain extent, is the opposite of what we did yesterday. With the Wild Man story and the Iron John story, you can see a typical initiation story from Northern Europe, and you can feel how long the process is. The wound which happened in the first section, with that little wound on the finger, is a place where we still are. And we have all the rest of the story to go through. Do you hear me? Only in the last 20 years have men really paid attention to their wound. It's a wonderful thing for me to watch that happen. But boy, that story went on a long ways after that, did you notice? So, where shame is, the wild man is not. Where the wild man is, shame is not. They can mutually occupy the same space. And the same thing is true, as women well know. Where shame is, the wild woman is not. Where the wild woman is, shame is at least temporarily not. Comes back, you know, but no. So that's why I want to put these not in opposition, but in compensation, what we're going to do yesterday and what we did today. And the mood will be quite different, because the mood of that story is so wonderful. How that which you despised in you for the male, that which you thought was underneath the water and insignificant and unworthy of being brought up, that which you have been taught to be ashamed of all your life, the wildness in you, which can be also considered in the male, his positive male sexuality. Males have been humiliated so often for their sexuality, and it's gotten deeper lately. It's mainly women that have done the humiliation. All men are rapists, etc. Many women saying all men are rapists. This penetrates to men. I want to remember one other thing, that you kept your divinity, Aphrodite. I mean, you kept her in memory. She stayed in memory, linking your sexuality to the divine. And I want you to remember that we lost ours. Dionysius. We lost all our connection of our sexuality with the divine. Jesus was not married. That's a great blow to men. Our sexuality is not in that thing. So we tend to regard our sexuality as completely secular. You're shaking your head. Tell me what you're thinking. That isn't it. That's not it. The issue is there a figure in the mythology that associates male sexuality with the divine? And it almost, in the Hindu mythologies, many of those, they're also fond of chastity. Shiva is divine. Inside the Shiva cult, there can be tremendous chastity. Let's not argue about it. I'm just trying to say, from the male point of view, when we look around for a figure that helps join our sexuality to the divine, we do not find it. everyone in it is you. He is not boiling a human being. He's boiling an image of authority. It's important for both of us, men and women, to boil our images of authority. Boil them. Is that clear what we're saying? How you want to expand that and all is another issue. That's a very subtle image. But we need to boil our images of authority. I love that detail. You can't just have them. You have to boil them and see what, you know, you boil milk and you get, you know, cheese, etc. Smelly cheese, good cheese. How to boil your images of authority. Otherwise, they'll control you. So he does that work. It's good work. Yes, Rachel. Okay, I want to continue. Thank you for his question is, Parsifal is an example of the young naive male. That's a long book after you meet him. And she says, what can be done now? Let's continue with this. After he is finished, therefore, the man comes back and said, you know, your 7 years are done, you've done all the wood. You looked into the pots, by the way. I know you did. If you hadn't put a lot of wood under, I would really have punished you. That's where that's under. If you hadn't put more wood under, I would have punished you. So then at the end of that time, he gives him his wages, which are little bits of shavings from behind the door. And the boy is very disappointed. Then when he goes up into our world, he's been in that world down there. When he comes up into our world, the shavings change into gold. That's what happens with those things we thought were unimportant down there. They change into gold on the way back to our world. And there he was with a sack full of gold now. And he's got his unshaven face and hair and everything. And he goes to an inn. And he says to the innkeeper, do you have a room? The innkeeper looks at him, sees the property value is going down. And says to him, well, you know, we got a convention coming in tomorrow. You got all the rooms to take, and I'm sorry. Then the boy makes his first mistake. He shows the gold to the innkeeper. The innkeeper says, oh, well, because I just remember my son-in-law is moving out of his room today. That's called the naive male. And he goes and gets to the room. The innkeeper comes in the middle of the night and steals the gold. Now, the rest of the story is another story. But that's the moment I want to show you. That moment in which the New Age male does all this work in spiritual work, in chanting and meditation and so on. Then he goes to a party, says the wrong thing, and loses it all. The tradition is, if you have some experience, you hold that. You don't blab it to everybody. The lack of reserve, the inability to hold things in. You understand me. Rilke says, tell a masked man or else, tell a wise person or else keep silent because the masked man will mock.